Radio Gorgeous supports women. Women support Radio Gorgeous.
We're here with Isabel Wolf and talking about your book, your latest book, Ghostwritten. And it is the story, well, you tell us.
The story is a dual timeline story about two women, one young and in her 30s and a woman in her 80s, about to be 80. And Jenny is the young ghostwriter, and she's commissioned to ghostwrite the memoirs of this elderly lady, Clara, who was interned during the war in the Far East, and now at last wants to tell her story. And her two sons have, one of her sons has met Jenny at a wedding and phones her up afterwards and says, I think you'd be interested in my mother's story. And at first Jenny's really interested and thinks this would be a great story, until she discovers that Clara lives, although she's Dutch, she's lived in Cornwall for 60 years, and she lives in a part of Cornwall that Jenny has a very, very sad memory of. A traumatic experience happened there when she was 9. It's the last place on earth that she would ever want to go back to, but something makes her decide she will go back there, she will take on this commission. It's really a novel about laying to rest the ghosts of the past. It's about a haunted ghostwriter and the woman who helps her to come to terms with this traumatic event. It's about the way they both heal each other in the end.
And Clara's story in the news recently, obviously everyone's talking about Richard Flanagan's
yes.
The Narrow Road to the Deep North, I
yes.
think it's called. And that's about the prisoners of war interned by the Japanese during World War II.
Yes. And of course, the Richard Flanagan, which is The Narrow Road to the Deep North, is a wonderful, wonderful, magnificent novel. But that's very much about the male, masculine story. The prisoners of war building the Thai-Burma railway. That's come to define the prisoner of war experience in the Far East that we've sort of all come to know about and understand. But there is this other side of the prisoner of war story, which is about what happened to the women and children who were already living in the region as the wives and children of planters, civil servants, missionaries. Some of them were themselves working as teachers. And they were just rounded up, herded into internment camps by the Japanese. There were 130,000 of them, the same number, interestingly, as there were male Allied prisoners of war. And they were interned in these really atrocious camps where they had to battle against starvation and cruelty, extreme deprivation, disease and despair. And so I wanted to write a novel that would put their ordeal and their courage at its heart.
And Clara was the daughter of Dutch farmers.
Yes.
And who lived on Java.
Yes.
And they had really quite an idyllic.
Oh, they did.
Hard-working, but idyllic.
They did.
Existence until World War II.
Yes. The Dutch were the largest group of Western civilians, most of whom were European, some of whom were Australian, and some of whom were American. But the biggest group by far were the Dutch. There were 108,000 Dutch people living in the Dutch East Indies, as it was then called, later to become Indonesia. And they were, as I say, planters, missionaries, teachers. And so they were living in this beautiful tropical island, the larger islands of Java, Sumatra, Borneo, Timor and Ambon. I focus on Java, which is the biggest island. There were a lot of internment camps on Java, and they were by far the worst. And so Clara was interned with her first of all, her father. The men were interned in men's camps. They were segregated. He was taken away first. And then Clara, her mother and little brother, were trucked away to an internment camp for women and children. And her memoir is about her struggle to survive in not just one internment camp, because they were moved around to other camps and herded onto dreadful cattle trucks and moved around the country to different camps. So it's all about this struggle to survive, this extreme privation, hunger and disease. And that makes it sound like a very grim story, but actually it's a redemptive story, because we meet Clara, she's 80 now, and we know that whatever she's endured, whatever horrors she endured as a child that no child should live through, she has survived.
Mm. And what are some of her experiences in the internment camps?
Well, the women were many of them had to do very hard labour. So her mother, for example, was set to work as a furniture lady. And what they would have to do is empty furniture, because some of the camps were in the jungle. I have to just set this up by saying some were jungle camps. But a lot of the camps were just cordoned off areas of the cities, like Bandung, Batavia and Malang. And the Japanese just cordoned off whole sort of quarters of the all the various streets, put barbed wire and this hated Gedek fence around them. And then the women would be billeted into houses, but instead of there being just one, you know, little family of four or five people in a house, there would be perhaps 70 or 80, all sleeping on the floor. They were allowed 30 centimetres width each for their mattresses. They'd hang their mosquito nets up. It'd be like living in a beehive. So it was chronic overcrowding. Can you imagine? You'd hear every sneeze, every cough. You'd hear people crying, babies screaming. It would be very, very distressing. I don't know how anybody got to sleep in such conditions. During the day, they would have this awful ordeal of tenko, which means counting, where they would have to stand in line because the Japanese were obsessed with keeping tabs on them. And they would have to stand there for hours in the blazing sun with no hats allowed, even for babies, and not even the elderly or children allowed to sit down. And it might take 2 or 3 hours, and they would be counted in their hundreds, if not thousands. And then they would be set to work. And Clara's mother worked as a furniture lady, shifting furniture out of these houses and putting it on a buffalo cart, which was a little wooden cart. And two women together would have to lift pianos, tables, cupboards. They would get very bruised faces and legs, you could imagine, from cupboard doors suddenly flying open, or, you know, stubbing their toes or having toes broken by things falling on their feet because they were just too heavy. They would then have to put them on the cart, and instead of the cart being pulled by a buffalo, the women themselves would have to put on the leather harness and somehow haul it down the street to another already emptied house, and then put the furniture in that for the future use of any Japanese family that might be coming to Java. So there were these awful experiences of really undignified and distressing work, also having to empty the, you can imagine, the sanitation was terrible because there were so many of them, and more arriving all the time as the Japanese moved them around and concentrated them into ever smaller areas, more and more people going into an area that they were then reducing in size, closing in the fence. And so they had terrible sanitation. So one of the most awful jobs was to have to empty the overflowing latrines, literally scooping out the poop,
excrement.
You know, the excrement with buckets. That was you can imagine, a hateful job. They'd have to mend the Gedek fencing. They would work in the kitchens, and that was dangerous, hauling huge steel drums that were used as saucepans, lifting those with wooden poles on and off these blazing fires, because that's where the food, or what passed for food, it was disgusting, tapioca gruel, like wallpaper paste. That's where that was prepared. So there were all sorts of horrifying things that they had to do because they were meant to be doing, in inverted commas, useful work. And they had no medicines. They had very little food. They were being worked just like the male prisoners of war. They were just being worked into the ground with a very low calorie intake. Apart from the fact that this was very distressing and exhausting work that really made them ill.
And one of the things Clara talked about and remembered was that, you know, in terms of this, women trying to do anything to put a little bit more food in their children's mouths, selling their clothing at the fence.
Yes.
Because it was in this city.
Yes.
You know, it was like a ghetto.
Yes. And one handkerchief would get you 2 or 3 bananas. If you had a dress or a shirt, that would get you 6, maybe even 10 eggs. Or a little bit of meat, and then you would rush back to your quarters, and they somehow still had a bit of electricity. They would put a little tin cup with water on the back of their clothing iron, and they would boil the snail. They also caught anything they could eat. The word inedible didn't exist. Snails, lizards, frogs, and they would cook those on the iron and cut that up to put in their children's rice. But these women, they were women who would walk through the sewers to trade at the fence. They would do anything to keep their child alive for one more day.
Including informing on another woman.
Yes, there was, like all, I think, wartime experience, which I never lived through, hope I never do. I feel like anyone born after, you know, the Second World War in the West is in a lucky position of never having been through what our parents' generation have been through. But yes, war brings out the best in people and the worst. And of course, there are women who were very noble. They shared their food. They helped each other. There was great camaraderie, a determination to support each other. But as time went on, they were there for 3.5 years. And they were losing so much of their body weight. They were like walking skeletons as well, just as the POWs were. And so for a woman to actually manage to get some food for her children and come back with a little bit of bacon and she's put it on the iron and she's heating it up for her children, there would be wails of despair and crying and rage from the other women because they hadn't been able to feed their children. And they would say in their desperation that they were going to betray her to the Japanese and tell them, and she would be beaten or she would be executed. I mean, there were terrible punishments. So there was that as well. There was the best and there was the worst, because they were all just so desperate to survive and desperate to keep their children alive. And one of the interesting things I discovered when I was doing my research was that of all the groups of women, there were of all ages, the biggest group to survive were the mothers, because the mothers could not afford to die. They had to keep living to keep their children alive. The elderly ladies, they gave up. A lot of those died. And the younger women, they gave in to despair. They didn't want to eat. They quite quickly succumbed. The mothers were, it is nature, I suppose, they were determined to live. They could not afford to die. And they, by and large, many did die, but not all by any means. Many, many of the mothers did survive.
Wow. What drew you to this story?
Well, it's interesting. I began first with the idea of the ghostwriter, because all my novels are written in the first person, and I always begin when I'm researching them with, what does this woman do for a living? Because once I know that, I know so much else about her life. And I'd always been interested in the idea of, gosh, a ghostwriter. How amazing to spend months and months working on a book that won't even have your name. No recognition, no byline. And I was very interested in the idea of that. It's like the opposite of what goes on today, when we all want to be celebrities and be on Facebook and be on Twitter and put ourselves out there. This is a young girl, Jenny. Well, I say young girl, she's in her 30s now, who wants to be invisible. So then I had to decide why. And I came up with this trauma from her childhood that had very much affected who she had become. Mm-hmm. She's someone living in the background of her own life, shunning the limelight, fearing exposure. But she loves writing. She loves stories. So she writes the memoirs of the elderly. That's her job. And then I had to decide, well, what's she going to ghostwrite? And I wanted it to be a wartime story, but not the war in Europe, because that's been written about a lot. And the war in the East hasn't been. There was Tenko, which was a wonderful series 30 years ago in the early 80s. And I do remember watching that. And I adored and have never forgotten the experience of reading for the first time A Town Like Alice, which still gives me goosebumps just thinking about it. A friend of my father, his name is Dennis, and he'd been in Burma on the prisoner of war, on the Thai-Burma railway. And I remember they were very nice people, but before they came, they used to visit us, there was always a hushed conversation between my parents. They would say, Dennis, he's quite delicate. He was in Burma during the war. He suffered. He had a terrible time. He can't eat very much now. And I never used to know what quite had happened. I was too young to have it explained, but I grew up knowing that terrible things had happened in the Far East, that people had barely survived and that many people hadn't survived. And I'd always sort of remembered that, the idea of the legacy of this horrendous experience in the Far East. But then I just thought more and more about the women. Tenko came back to me. A Town Like Alice came back to me. I thought, I'm going to write about what happened to the women and children. Partly also because my audience is mostly, you know, women read my books. But it's a story that's been very much overshadowed by the male story, the masculine story. But the experience of internment for women was just as harrowing, I would say, as captivity was for any man.
Mm-hmm. And not dissimilar from other than the organized execution of Jews. But it's a concentration experience is a concentration experience.
Yes. I don't think it can be compared to the Holocaust. It wasn't the industrialization of death, that grotesque blot on the history of the world that is the Holocaust. They didn't set out to kill them all. They were incompetent. They suddenly found themselves with vast numbers of prisoners of war.
Interesting.
And civilians. Mm. The Japanese themselves, I think, were surprised. They overran Southeast Asia in 9 weeks. From Pearl Harbor to the fall of Singapore is about 100 days. And they just conquered the whole region. And then they found, well, what are we going to do with all these people? Now what? So the men, they transported in these hell ships by the thousand to Japan, where they worked in mines. They transported them to Thailand to construct the 250-mile Burma Railroad. They transported them to Singapore, where they built the airfields, and they worked them in quarries as well. So they got the men out of to where they wanted to use them as slave labour. The women, they just rounded up into these camps, and then were totally incompetent at sort of running the camps in an efficient way. Mm. So that through this neglect, and also they did starve them because they were stockpiling the rice. So yes, they did starve them. And I don't know what they thought was going to happen to a woman who's only allowed to eat one cup of rice a day. So it was an atrocity, mostly. And the biggest number of women and children to suffer this were the Dutch.
RadioGorgeous.com.
And we are in the 100th year after World War One.
Yeah.
And many people came back after World War One and did not speak of their experiences. And Clara doesn't speak of her experiences.
Yes.
She, like the young woman Jenny, has hidden this trauma away. And she ends up eliciting more of Clara's story, you know, than her sons have ever heard.
Yes.
And partially, I thought it was why, one of the reasons why Clara in particular didn't talk about it, is when these Dutch, the survivors, were then sent back after the war to Holland, the Dutch in Holland were not receptive to any idea of trauma. They're like, you've been on holiday.
Yeah.
You came back tan and thin and whatnot, you know. I mean, but they really, you know, they felt that their deprivation.
Yes. They were not sympathetic. Everyone has their own pain, their own suffering, and we feel it in our all in our own way. And so for the Dutch who'd had the Nazis, who had had the hunger winter, where they themselves were starved because the north of Holland was blockaded, and they were tearing down their cupboards, burning their tables, they were digging up tulip bulbs to eat, they had been reduced to the most terrible condition themselves. And then after the end of the war, all the people came back from the Far East. Some of them had never even been to Holland, been born in Java or Sumatra or wherever. And the Dutch, I think, were resentful at having to, as it were, look after these people who they felt hadn't had as bad a time as they had had. So there was hostility. And I think many people returning from the Far East just learned not to talk about what they had been through, that their war had been different. Their war had been the war of the Gedek and beatings and beriberi and dysentery and, the tapioca gruel and having your face slapped for not bowing quickly enough to a Japanese soldier or being tied to a chair in the sun as a punishment. That was their war. And the war that the Dutch in Holland had suffered was a different kind of suffering, of the suffering of occupation, but also starvation and terrible things that they had been through. So everyone suffers in their own way.
Yeah, but they also didn't, I guess there was the feeling of the people who stay, it was like, well, you left.
Yes, pampered colonials.
Yes.
Why and should we life, care about you?
And their life had been quite pampered and lovely prior.
I've had a few Dutch readers who've read the book in English and in fact, I haven't got a Dutch publisher yet, which is interesting. It's interesting. I haven't got a Dutch publisher, but some of the Dutch readers have said, this isn't taught in Holland. I didn't know about this, and I'm Dutch. They'll talk about the Nazis, of course, but the war in the East isn't something that's as much on the minds of people in Holland isn't taught very much. That's something I've heard several times, so I guess it must be true.
And we, you know, in England we don't hear about it much, but I understand Nick Clegg's mother was an internee.
She was in Chideng. Chideng was one of the worst camps in what was then called Batavia, which is now modern Jakarta, and that was a cordoned off area of Batavia called Chideng. And she was there. She was there from the ages of 6 to 9 with her mother and her two sisters. They were very lucky because they survived, but she was. They were close to death, and had the war not ended when it did, they would all have starved. Actually, they were very, very close to being in the final stages of starvation. Once you've lost. They'd mostly lost 30% of their body weight. To lose 40% of your body weight is fatal.
Right.
You know, the atomic bombs were dropped on... It was the 6th and the 9th of August 1945, and that ended the war, and then liberation was on the 15th of August, and then the Red Cross came in with food, and people gradually began to recover, but they were told they still couldn't eat very much because they had been so starving that it would have killed them to have tried to eat anything like a normal portion of food.
Yeah.
But when they were in the camps, they were so hungry. This is an amazing thing. This astounded me. That what they would do, they became obsessed with swapping recipes. And they would rush around to each other's quarters and sit down and discuss, you know, swap the recipe, and everybody would then write the ingredients down on some, if they could find a little bit of paper or a bit of pencil, because they had absolutely nothing. And they would write the recipes down, and then they would discuss the preparation, and then they would mentally eat, in inverted commas, this delicious dish that they knew they would probably never get to eat. And that somehow alleviated their hunger.
And in your research, did you find some of these?
Yes, I found these things from talking to two survivors who were children, and also I've been in conversation with Mrs. Clegg, and also from reading autobiographical memoirs that have been translated from Dutch into English. There are a few of those, and I read those, and they all sort of said the same sort of things. They all talked about the recipes, they all talked about the transports, they all talked about Tenko, they talked about having their faces slapped because they hadn't bowed quickly enough, this sort of thing. So it was very dismaying, really, to read, but that's where this is from the people who'd been there themselves, so that was a very important part of my research, and I did go to Java myself, and just to see where these people had been held. So I went, you know, to Jakarta and Bandung, and I saw the houses that were used as for all these internees, and that was very interesting. I felt more connected to the story than going there.
Yeah.
And by the end of the war, the Japanese, I think they just wanted to destroy the entire sort of Dutch colonial presence. They wanted it out. The Dutch had been there for 350 years. Whatever you think about, you know, colonialism, they had been there for a very long time and done some bad things and probably done some good things. You know, it's a mixed story.
Yeah, so the Indonesians by that time wanted them out as well.
They wanted them out, and the Japanese really played on that. And that's how the Japanese would say it's going to be, you know, the greater Asian co-prosperity sphere, Asia for the Asians. And so the Indonesians were quite welcoming of the Japanese. Many of the Indonesians were. So, but the Japanese just, they wanted to reduce the Dutch colonial people to the status of slaves. And so by the end of the war, these people not only were starving, they had so little. The women were wearing, they had no bras anymore, so they wore old tea towels tied around their chests. They're very thin chests by then. On their feet, they either had wooden clogs that sort of local people wear, very, very broken down ones, I imagine, and rubber sandals made out of strips of rubber tires that they somehow fashioned, good word, into these sort of rough sandals. Many of them were completely barefoot. And they used everything. If they had to mend something, they would pull a thread from a dress, and that piece of cotton would then mend something else. And nothing was ever wasted. And for the children, they had no toys. And I've read heartbreaking accounts of little children. They were so exhausted, so malnourished, just sitting on the very broken down pavement in these camps, these city camps, just pretend playing with their hands, that their fingers were characters, and they would wiggling their fingers and making their fingers talk to each other and have little adventures. This is what they were reduced to. And there's one woman I remember, she said she had a memory of her little brother trying to make a toy out of two rusty nails, and she said that memory still made her cry. So this, they were reduced to extreme privation, and it's a very, very sad chapter, actually. And all chapters in anything to do with war are dreadful and awful, but these were just women and children, not non-combatants, nothing to do with the war. Just, it was as though they were just in the area the Japanese invaded, and it was as though they were trapped where they stood, as though a net had fallen over the whole region, and they there was no time to evacuate them. There was nowhere for them to go. They wouldn't be able to survive if they hid among, you know, they would be very conspicuous. They couldn't escape from these camps, so they just had to cope as best they could inside them.
Yeah. And there was also, you know, since the men were in other camps.
Yes.
What you feared, and you heard horrible things from those. So what you feared as a mother most was that your children would grow.
Yes.
And your boys would be old enough to be sent to the men's camp.
This was their absolute nightmare for the mothers of boys, because at the beginning of the war, the segregated camps were for men and boys over 15. And the women could take their boys up to the age of 15 and all younger children into the women and children's camps with them. But gradually the Japanese began, they didn't like having these young boys. They were worried that they were going to, you know, try and sort of gang up against them, or, you know, they were quite, you know, having strong young boys, they were strong at the beginning of the war. So they began to reduce the age at which the boys were transferred to men's camps. So it went down and down from 15, 12, 13, and by 1944, boys of 10 were being transferred to men's camps. And in fact, I even heard that boys of 8 and 9 were. And you can imagine, they didn't even look like they were 8 or 9. They looked like they were 5 or 6, because they were so malnourished.
And
so for the mother, this is part of the story, that Jenny's, that Clara's mother, Annika, was terrified that Clara's little brother, Peter, because he's coming up to the age of 10, is going to be transferred to a men's camp, because she doesn't believe he'll survive it. And so she's desperate to keep him with her. You know, she's lying about his age. She's saying, no, he's not 10. That's a mistake. He's 9. And so part of the story is about this great blot that Clara feels she has on her conscience, which is similar to what Jenny feels she has in her life, that this something happened. Clara feels responsible for something that happened to her little brother. And she was put in a position where she had to make an impossible choice when she was in the camp. And she was just a little girl herself, and she was being tortured. And this is an important part of the narrative. So it's about the terrible things that happened during war, and how men, women and children, but there's somehow, it's even more pitiable for women and children being caught up in the tide of a terrible war. And when I went to Java, I went to the Dutch War Cemetery, which is called Everard Pandu. And there is this, it's a very wonderful cemetery, actually, beautifully maintained by the Dutch War Graves Commission. And there's the Dutch Field of Honour, which is for the civilians. And the crosses, white crosses, stretch in all directions as far as the eye can see. And on many of these crosses, it says onbekend, which means unknown. And there are so many little crosses. And it's heartbreaking. And so many crosses that are women. And I did find that very, very moving, to stand there and to think of the story and the suffering that had led these poor people to be buried in this cemetery, just innocent victims of this terrible part of World War II.
Wow, very moving. And the book is wonderful. It includes all of this and all of this story, but it is also a moving and wonderful read in and of itself, lest people think they're reading a history book. But we were supposed to do this interview earlier this year.
We were, yes.
We were scheduled, and then I didn't hear from you,
yeah,
and I was worried. And what had happened?
Oh, something absolutely ghastly and violent actually happened to me on June the 27th. I was walking my dog. I live in Notting Hill. And I made the mistake of going off the main road. It was about 10:30. I'd been out to dinner with a girlfriend, came back, and I always take our little Cocker Spaniel, Alfie, out for a walk last. You know, you have to last thing at night. They need to do their, you know what. So I don't know. I was just walking down a very expensive road, actually, called Dawson Place Road, a very big, you know, huge houses that cost many millions.
Mansion tax.
Yeah. A few streets away from our house, which is not like that at all. But and anyway, I just turned. Something made me turn as I came towards the end of the road. And I just saw two men coming towards me in the shadows. And I thought, I have to get out of here. And my first thought was that they were going to steal my dog. That was my first thought, because he's a very beautiful black Cocker Spaniel, very lovely. So I began to just walk very, very quickly. But before I could even get 2 or 3 feet down the road, they were on me. And one of them clapped his hand over my mouth and said, "Don't scream, don't make a sound, or we'll hurt you. Or you won't be hurt," I can't remember, something like that. Then I was dragged to the ground and I was lying on the ground. I'm still hanging on to the dog for dear life. And I thought, why am I lying on the ground? And I thought I was going to be raped. I didn't understand. I didn't have my handbag with me. I just had an old coat on. But then I realised that the other man was tearing at my left hand, on which I had my lovely diamond ring, which I always wore. Funnily enough, I thought it was safest as long as it was on my hand. And to cut a long story short, I was held down and being sort of stifled, sort of suffocated by the one man in order not to scream, while the other man tried incompetently, and it was very difficult to get this ring off because my hand was already slightly swollen from a mosquito bite. And I was down there for quite a long time, and anyway, in the course of this, to cut a long story short, he broke my finger. Mm-hmm. So he did get the ring in the end, because a car came along and it was now or never. So that is what my hand looks like now. Mm. Not quite as nice as the other hand. Mm. But so I spent a lot of time I spent most of the summer going to the wonderful hand unit at the Chelsea Westminster Hospital. And that's why I just missed the interview with you, because it blotted everything out. And I've never had an experience, I'm glad to say, of anyone being violent to me. I now have had that experience of a man, two men actually, it was very cruel, being violent to, it was a woman walking her dog. And I can only tell you that it is a very subduing experience in which you feel quite changed afterwards actually. I'm only just now, it's 4 months later, I'm beginning to feel little get myself back. I'm beginning to, I've got used to this, to the finger being bent and, you know, not looking as it should. I have to now wear, if I ever wear rings like this is an expandable one, they have to open because my knuckle is bigger than it was, sadly. But I might have the knuckle replaced. They've got little joints that they can do. I'll see how I get on.
Oh,
I'll
wow.
see it in a year's time, because it's it doesn't
You're
work nearly as well. And
yep.
it's not quite so good for, I can type. I can still play the piano, luckily, because obviously the melody is carried in the right hand more than the left hand, is just usually chords. But so that is not too effective. Not that I'm a great pianist or anything, but I enjoy playing the piano. But so, yes, that is why I completely forgot our interview in early July, because I was probably in the just Westminster Hospital having yet another x-ray.
Yeah.
So that was...
And did you find, you said, I mean, it's sort of, were you surprised at... how consuming an attack like that
yeah.
could be
it,
in terms of how it affects you. You think, it's just a physical thing.
Yes.
They broke my finger.
Yes. I thought, there are far worse things than a broken finger, which of course there are.
Mm-hmm.
We know that. So I thought I would get over it, that I'm old enough and ugly enough, as it were, to deal with something like this, that it was unfortunate. I'd made a mistake. I was, although actually...
Blamed yourself.
You see, that's interesting, because I hadn't made a mistake. My misfortune, not my mistake, was to walk down this road. It wasn't that late. Notting Hill is very busy until about 3 a.m. But my mistake was to walk down that very quiet road where I think they were just lurking, looking for someone to mug. And then I came back. And apparently they target women with dogs and also women with prams because they don't run away. So, yes, sort of blaming myself, that's interesting. What I wasn't prepared for is how profoundly differently it would make me feel about myself. I became very withdrawn. I wasn't ringing friends, didn't want to see anyone, didn't tell anyone, certainly didn't tweet or Facebook about it. I'm talking about it now because you've asked me, and because I missed the interview because of it, and I'm happy to talk about it now.
Did you feel somewhat ashamed?
I felt ashamed. I felt a deep sense of shame. I felt as though I'd brought it on myself. All these things that you read about, and I think, oh, that's crazy. How could a poor woman think?
How could you possibly think?
But actually, I did. So, and I then became quite very jumpy, you know, quite ratty with the children, I have to say, you know, feeling that they were going to come and get me again, feeling every time I went out, they would be there waiting to attack me again. So that was very unpleasant. And people, friends of my close friends said, oh, you should go and have counselling. And I haven't done that. Maybe I will in the future. I don't know. I'm waiting to see how it all settles down. But it's 4 months now and I'm beginning to feel, you know, sort of more like my old self again.
That goes back to one of the things that you were writing about in your book.
Yes.
You know, these, both of these women as young girls were victims of circumstance.
Yes.
And yet took the blame on themselves.
Yes.
And that's a very common female story.
Yes, to blame them. And they've lived with that for years and years. Mm-hmm. That's right. And it did make me think about the book even more when I'd been attacked myself. I thought, and now I can understand how, in my case, the violence was incidental. They were robbing me. They didn't set out to hurt me. So it must be even worse if someone sets out to hurt you. Oh, my gosh.
And like, you said, I didn't want to tell my friends.
No,
I didn't talk about it.
No.
Well, and then you understand, okay, they've been through the trouble. They haven't told their families.
Yes.
They haven't, you know,
yes.
Then, you have a little taste of the magnitude of
exactly.
They experienced.
Because people who've been through such violence, people who had their, you know, jaws broken, they've been beaten to the ground, they've had their noses broken, they've had their heads shaved, because that was a common punishment. It was so common that the women would just tie a scarf around their bloodied scalp, because it was done very badly as well. They were injured, but they would just carry on. And other women would cut off bits of their hair and stick it to the front of the scarf, so the other shaved woman felt a little bit more normal. But yes, to be subjected to that kind of deliberate cruelty and violence, it's absolutely unimaginable. And yet we know how all too common this has been. And yes, nobody wants to talk about it. It's too deep for words. And there is a sense of shame, even though this is not their fault. So I did, yes, it did give me an even greater understanding of that. And we know that people who have been through these traumas, they don't talk. They can't find the words. And Clara eventually, she's decided she's about to be 80, and her friend is losing her memory. Her friend Jane has got dementia, and that is the trigger. And Clara thinks, I have to. Memory is all we own. Mm-hmm. Everything else can be taken away from us, but our memories are all we really own. Once they've gone, then who are we? So this, I think, is also the trigger that makes her decide, I will tell my story. And it's Jenny who comes into her life, and Jenny is the person who helps her to tell it and helps to heal herself in the process.
Thank you so much for coming on Radio Gorgeous.
Thank you very much.
This has been a Radio Gorgeous production for RadioGorgeous.com. Get in contact with us, contact us on info@RadioGorgeous.com, and to sign up for our shows to come once a week into your inbox. Who can think of anything better, darling?
The Kais call me Yem, but I see not me in ye. The Kais call me Yem, but I see not me Ben. I'd rather lose all the Kai than lose me in ye. I'd rather lose all the Kai than lost me Ben. Thank you. bear. Fresh faced is me hinny, his blue eyes are bonny, his hair and curled ringlets hang sweet to the sight. So mount the old pony, seek after me hinny, bring back to his mummy her only delight. Through hedges and ditches and valleys and hillsides, I hope that me hinny may come to me harm. Well, I've searched in the meadow and in the far acre, through stackyard and byre, but nowt could I find. So off ye gan, this mummy some peace to her
see you.
This has been a Radio Gorgeous production 2014, produced and presented by Donna Freed, edited by Bree Forer.